Let's Talk Development, Season 3, Episode 8.
So, hello everyone, and welcome once again to the Let's Talk Development podcast. This is by CDPR and IGC. With this particular podcast, we look at the human side of development. And in this particular episode, we're going to talk about inequality, inclusion, and the power of expression. And we have what I think is a perfect guest for this program, somebody who has a very strong academic background in politics and the humanities, Dr. Taimur Rehman here at LUMS, and also a very prominent side career as a musician and as a political activist. So, Dr. Rehman, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Fasi. Thank you for that introduction.
So, I'm going to just start off immediately. So, Isme, you know, I one of the things that I thought I'd ask very quickly is that there's this question about, like, everyone pursues economic growth. Is that problematic?
Not in and of itself. I mean, I think economic growth needs to be one of the goals that we do pursue. And in that also we can differentiate between the kind of economic growth that we pursue in the sense of whether we're just increasing our GDP, which can also be the result of various speculative and other things, cryptocurrency and the movement of certain kinds of, you know, revenue can have that effect, or whether we're actually building productive capacity, we're increasing the productivity of labor. So the latter kind, where the productivity of labor is increasing, is something that I find to be a goal that's definitely worth pursuing. But having said that, however, then, of course, we get into the issue of, well, if the productivity of labor is growing, what is happening with that new productivity? Is it all going to a particular small class of people, what we like to call elite capture? Is it being shared more equitably? Is it really being distributed or managed in a manner which will make it sustainable, or make that growth sustainable? So growth is not something that, I mean, for instance, there is a group of thinkers, economists, or whatever you want to call them, who talk about zero growth.
Yeah.
And I think that could be applicable to certain economies that are way ahead of the curve, first world countries and that sort of thing, even though there are some terrible problems there as well. But and certain environmentalists certainly are very, very much in favor of this idea of zero growth because of the negative effect on the environment. But if we're talking about a third world country like Pakistan, then I think that the growth of the productivity of labor, the development of industry, that sort of thing, is a goal that's worth pursuing. But is it the only goal? Is it the only metric? There, of course, I have my
difficulty. I'm going to ask a follow-up question to this. So, for example, is it that in our pursuit of growth, we've also accepted that we will have increased inequality?
That's one way to put it. Yeah. Absolutely, that's one way to put it. But I would say that it follows as a necessary consequence of the model of development that most third world countries have adopted. And that follows of necessity out of the very class structure of the kind of societies we have. The kind of, you know, elite capture, this is a big buzzword these days, But the kind of society we have predisposes us towards a certain set of policies that favor a certain class. And the illusion is that if we favor that class, somehow everybody will be better off.
Yes.
Whereas that's not always the case.
So, again, I mean, there's the opposite of this, which is inclusive growth.
Yes, sure.
Which is that you make sure that the growth tends to bring people up.
Absolutely.
Across the board.
Absolutely.
But I'm just wondering, is that something of the past, given how, you know, around the world, they've reacted against things that have that welfare capitalist model.
Yeah.
Whereas they're removing a great degree of, you know, regulations just to make sure, and then there's these new technologies. So how would you do inclusive growth for Pakistan?
Now, this is the fascinating thing, that a lot of economic data suggests that the view that was widely prevalent in the 1990s, which is the what we call the neoliberal view. Wo ye tha ke bhai state khatam kar do. We don't need any, you know, we don't need to regulate finance capital. We don't need to regulate international trade through tariffs and barriers. We don't need to, you know, do any of the things make the state do anything other than just collect taxes and manage law and order and so on. So the Night's Watchman sort of ideology. Ab dilchasp baat ye hai ki there are two things that have happened in the world that have completely destroyed this point of view, even though economists on the whole are yet to catch up. The first is that, in fact, where these models have been applied, growth has not accelerated. This is the big, big, big picture, and the biggest and most important aspect that is neglected. So the high point of growth in the 20th century in the world capitalist, let's ignore the socialist bloc for a while, in what we call market economies, was in the post-Second World War period till about the OPEC crisis and the 70s. This, if we look at the United States of America, you look at European Union, you look at any of these countries, this is the point at which they're growing rapidly, they're developing a massive middle class, they're developing a huge sector where people are able to consume, and it's on the basis of that, you know, sort of demographic, the boomers or whatever you want to call them, that you have, you know, enormous growth. Now, after the OPEC crises, both of them, 73 and later in 79, there's a huge restructuring in the first world, Reagan, Thatcher, neoliberalism, etc. One of your favorites, Hayek, becomes the order of the day.
Yes.
Mises and Hayek come to dominate.
Yes.
But what is the result? Now, when we look at the world economy, not any specific economy, when we look at the world economy, from 1980 till today, here's the interesting thing that you discover, that the overall growth rate of the economy has not increased. It's actually gone down. So you had more growth in the period that we refer to as Keynesian demand management or Keynesian management. You have more growth from 45 till about, let's say, 75 in the middle of the two OPEC crises than you do from 75 till 2025. This is very, very strange. And this is something that, I mean, this is data that's now very well, highly well established. So what is happening is that that in fact Keynes, to a very large extent, in my view, has proven to be right, that the growth from 45 to 75 was driven by the fact that you had these policies in place which managed aggregate demand or managed consumption in such a way as to produce a continuous growth throughout without that kind of boom-bust cycle that we see. And at the same time, you saw the expansion of the middle class and so on. Now that all of that is out of the window, you're seeing a reversion to what you saw in the 19th century and the early 20th century, which is you have rapid periods of growth, let's say the 20s. And these are booming years. And then suddenly you have periods of utter destruction, whether you look at, you know, the Great Depression of 28, 29, or you look at the enormous depression in 2008. So, and they, in fact, cancel each other out. So if you look at shorter periods, you say, oh, my God, this economy is growing at 5%. Isn't that incredible, thanks to neoliberalism? But then a couple of years later, they're like at 1%, or they're like at... you know, in terms of real growth, in terms of GDP per capita, they might be at 0%.
If I could just add one thing, and we'll move on to another one, but I was just wondering, is like this whole Keynesian thing.
Yes.
Do you think it's possible today, given how much more a role private capital has, the scale of it, the lack of, you know, that the state is a smaller player?
Right.
Yeah.
And this brings me perfectly into my second point.
Yes.
Which was, the first point was, of course, that if you look at growth rates, just to repeat, sorry,
yeah.
being a professor, I have this habit, which is that growth was actually higher in that period of demand management and state intervention. But the second point is also very interesting, which is what's happening right now in the world is extremely interesting. The United States of America has imposed enormous tariffs on, you know, pretty much everybody.
They've become mercantilists.
They have become mercantilists.
Yes.
Where is neoliberalism? Yes. It's gone. And this is, if we think that this is just an aberration because of Trump or something, that would not be correct. The whole establishment is going along with it. There's a, you know. So what's happening is that, in fact, the United States of America, which is the original heartland of the ideology of neoliberalism, has itself now thrown neoliberalism overboard. Mm. It's rejected it. It's saying, this is not working. We're not going to have free trade. We're going to have protectionism. And, and other, in fact, also we're bound to see other forms of state intervention. NATO spending is not necessarily in the way of welfare, but NATO spending is going up, military spending is going up, all these. The state isn't becoming smaller. It's just shifting its focus away from welfare to other things. But it's still a massive state. Mm. It occupies anywhere between 35 to 45, sometimes 50% of gross GDP in first world countries is really still centered around the state.
So I just want to take it to another area, and sure. That is that, you know, when we're looking to include people in Pakistan, yes. In its progress. So I'm just wondering, like, in your, you know, sort of academic work and all that, it's like we have a tool at our hands, which is, say, the quota.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way of making sure that the state is represented.
Mm-hmm.
We have things like the National Finance Commission Award.
Yes.
What else do you think is required? So now we've got parts of Pakistan, mm-hmm. and we've their issues, their sort of articulations are viewed with great degrees of suspicion,
mm-hmm.
and within Pakistan they've become the other.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you include those populations into the growth trajectory of Pakistan?
That's a very complex question. Can't be answered so easily.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think quotas and that sort of thing are just kind of they're band-aid solutions. Mm. I mean, in fact, if your policy mix is optimum, in my view, you should not need to have quotas,
mm.
because you should be able to manage all of that without this kind of external imposition,
yeah.
that we're going to take this many people from this group and that many people from that group. Because you would have a situation, let's say, in education, if you were able to offer good standard education for everyone, then you wouldn't really need to be thinking about quotas, would
yeah.
you? And that ought to be the goal. The goal shouldn't be, okay, all right, we have, 100 seats and we want them to be distributed equally. The goal ought to be, well, actually, we have 1,000 students who want to be educated. So how do we get to 1,000 seats? That ought to be the goal. But Pakistan is a complex case because in addition to the pressures that are within the country, you have the pressure which is outside of the country. You have you have the International Monetary Fund.
Yeah.
You have massive loans, and you have to pay them back, and you have to get further loans to keep the economy running. And to do that, you have to then agree with the structural adjustment policies, or whatever you want to call them, poverty, alleviation, strategy papers.
Pain policies.
Yeah. And all of these, pain policies, exactly. Yeah. Now, all of these austerity measures, we cannot consider them under any circumstances to be inclusive. Now, I can even submit or concede that there need to be certain very, very important changes. Because the way that public finance is managed at the moment is a mess. That's absolutely correct. But why should the cuts come from... The cuts generally come from the people who are the most vulnerable.
True.
The cuts generally come from people
who are... The development budget is the first that gets out.
Yes. Absolutely. They generally come from people who are the least powerful. They will almost never come from something like 2/3 of Pakistan's debt is owed to Pakistani banks.
Mm-hmm.
But can the Pakistani government restructure that? Why isn't the Pakistani government consider restructuring the debt which it owes to Pakistani banks, which is a much easier thing to do than to restructure the debts with international lenders, right? And that would create financial space. But that's not even on the table, is it? I mean, when the budget was passed just now, did anybody discuss in mainstream media, well, why don't we, 55% of the budget is going to debt repayment, out of which a significant portion, 2/3, is going to debt repayment within Pakistan. Have we considered restructuring that debt repayment?
Mm-hmm.
No discussion at all. That could be a serious discussion. There can be no discussion, especially after, India-Pakistan war, re-examining non-combat expenditures that the military makes. There can be no discussion of that. Military, generally, how things proceed is they put forward, we need this much money, and that's it. That's a given.
Mm.
And similarly, the banks are saying, well, you owe us this much money, so that's a done. That's a given. Well, that's 80% right there. More than that, in fact, right? That's almost 85% of the budget right there is gone. So the adjustment is, what you and I are discussing is the rest of the 15%.
Yeah.
And out of that, interestingly, another huge percentage, something to the tune of 2 trillion rupees, goes to the IPPs, which was itself the result of that neoliberal framework. If we're going to privatize power. We'll privatize power not by privatizing VAPTA, but we'll privatize power basically by getting private companies to this to give us electricity. Now look at that, such a huge disaster, Fuzzy. Even from within the framework of the market economy, it's cheaper for you and me to go and get a solar panel installed with a battery than it is for us to buy from the grid, which is insane because the grid has economies of scale, massive economies of scale. It should be way cheaper than solar, but it's not the case. So that shows you that the particular contract we have with the IPPs has, which is not a market mechanism, by the way. It's something that the state has done. It's what we call a sovereign guarantee. But it's priced electricity out of the market. Mm. Now, private electricity through solar panels cheaper than what we get from the government.
Yeah.
And so that would be a major restructuring that we need to think about. These are the kind, but this never happens. Rarely happens because these are powerful people, and powerful people get their way.
So I'm going to ask a question which also will, not just on your academic work, but also on some of the political work that you do.
Sure.
Now, we have always wondered that how do we get the marginalized to be part of the conversation and to benefit mm-hmm. from the state itself.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing that we've seen, which is not because of Pakistan, it's something that's happened around the world, which is the diffusion of these sharing technologies on social media and all that.
Absolutely.
But what we've also seen is that where there was a promise, increasingly a peril of an absolute breakdown in narratives, increase in polarization. In fact, even the government sometimes is held hostage to public opinion online.
Hmm.
So I'm just wondering, is that in terms of the work that you've seen and you've gone out into the field, and do you find that, with social media and these particular technologies, that there's been a net good that's come out of it, or are we actually moving towards a situation where we might become ungovernable because consensus is almost impossible now?
Well, the promise that was made when social media, came on the scene from Silicon Valley was that now all knowledge will be liberated and that we'll be able to talk to each other that barriers will be eliminated. That promise has turned out to be quite bitter.
Mm.
It hasn't been fulfilled at all. I think the reason has to do with the political economy of social media. There's an interesting statistic which says, Fasi, that basically there are 1% people, out of all the social media consumers, there are essentially 1% people that are producing what we call content.
Mm.
There are about 9% people that what we call the sharers, the people who actively share stuff. And the rest of the 90% people are basically just passive consumers of what is being produced by that 1% and shared by the 9%. So that, and out of that 1%, in fact, the traditional media houses have, of course, cornered much of that 1%. So if I look at what are the biggest social media outlets in Pakistan, what we would consider to be independent producers are conspicuous by their rarity, not by their preponderance. The main producers of social media are still going to be people who have a financial stream which allows them to do something of that sort. And so, and that means that the religious right many a times and the right in other instances in the context of the conservative right or what we call the alt-right has in fact managed to corner the social media scenario in a huge way. Take, for example, the fact that Elon Musk himself bought out Twitter.
Mm.
I mean, so much for the village square or the town square being a space of free speech.
Yes.
He can alter the algorithm in such a way that it favors his right-wing politics. Similarly, with respect to Facebook, this is a corporation we're talking about. We're not talking about you and I talking directly to each other. We can do that, but that's not what Facebook newsfeed is actually all about. It's actually about a product driven by advertising, as Mark Zuckerberg has himself very explicitly said, which of course drives the algorithm, which is I need to look at stuff which the advertisers can utilize, blah, blah, blah. Similarly, with respect to YouTube and others, although YouTube, in my view, is still slightly better than these two.
It's fairly reasonable compared to the others.
Yes, I agree.
And actually, I mean, just as an aside, I found what was supposed to be vapid, but actually has some of the best people on board is Instagram.
Instagram also, yes. It's not as political as Twitter, let's say, but yes, you're right. So anyway, it depends also on the, no doubt, on the kind of platform and the way things are organized on the platform. But as a rule of thumb, this is what's happened. That there's 1% people who are producing. If you corner that 1% market, you can shape the narrative, whichever way you like. There will be challenges. There'll always be the Greta Thunbergs and the, others, etc., who are out there in the field and saying, you know, we're opposed to this and we're opposed to genocide and so on.
Yeah.
But if you corner that 1% of producers, you can, and people know this already. I mean, people who work in social media know this. So if I'm a big politician and I have tax money, then I know that there are maybe 10, 20 key influencers that I need to get on my side to move the narrative a certain way in the context of Pakistan. Maybe I'm exaggerating. Maybe there's 50, I don't know. Hmm. But not more than that, right? It'll move the narrative. I think to then turn around and blame the public and say, oh, yes, the public's fault. We can't agree on anything. There's no consensus. No, there's. I mean, what Chomsky described as the six corporations that control about 90% of the media, they are able to drive the agenda. We are responding to that agenda. We're not the agenda setters, even on social media. And so that is, in my view, continuing to cause the polarization. To blame it on the public is... The public arguably could come to a better understanding of what's going on, what needs to be done, if these impediments were not in place. If social media truly was a space, a public square for debate and discussion, it would be different. But it's not. That illusion, I think, has to be countered, because these are corporations, huge corporations.
So I'm just going to add one thing, which is linked to this. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've had times where, and this is interesting because it's almost worldwide, mm. we've had times where people have been demanding that their material circumstances become better.
Mm-hmm.
But we've seen that the past 10 years especially revolve around identity politics.
Yeah.
Why do you think that shift has happened? Because those material issues have not been resolved.
Well, if you want to go the route of, I have an interesting conspiracy theory. I know you find conspiracy theories interesting.
Very interesting, yes. Yeah.
So you recall that during the Obama period, especially around 2008, there was the Occupy Wall Street movement.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, the idea that we are the 99% and we're against the 1%.
Yes.
And then we see the rise of the woke movement. So one interesting conspiracy theory is that the Democratic Party drove the woke movement in order to disperse the Occupy Wall Street and 99% movement, which was purely driven on this idea of... We are Main Street, and these people are Wall Street, and that's what we're against.
Hmm.
And Democratic Party is very close to the Wall Street, so that's one. And then, of course, other people got on that bandwagon, and the Republican right, and so on and so forth. Everybody pretty much got on that bandwagon from a different point of view, but that then had its own momentum and drove the cultural wars. But here's the most interesting thing that I find about this particular moment in time. Palestine has had a huge impact on identity politics.
Yeah.
In fact, in my opinion, it's all but destroyed it, in the sense that the big figures of woke politics and the cultural wars from the left of the political spectrum have decidedly shifted away from what I like to call navel gazing.
Mm.
And started to focus, number one, on imperialism as a serious problem in the world. Number two, started to focus much more on class questions and also started to build the idea that we cannot be divided on the basis of our separate identities. They are separate identities, we accept that.
Mm.
But they are emphasizing more and more now what brings us together. So take, for example, Mahmoud Mamdani's recent election campaign and subsequent victory. Now, sorry, Mahmood Mamdani is his dad. I mean, Zohran Mamdani.
Yes.
Mahmood Mamdani is a big favorite of mine because I've grown up reading his books.
Right, yes.
Zohran Mamdani is your
tip. Cherry picked these days to be totally pilloried. Yes.
True. So Zohran, is your typical woke generation fellow, right? He was in favor of all the kinds of things that generation was in favor of. We won't go into what those were, but everybody knows what they are, right? The politics of sexuality and sexual difference and fluidity, all of these things, right? But now look at his speeches of late and during this campaign. He is focusing, he's saying, yes, we have these differences, but our main struggle is the class struggle. That's not the words he uses, but that's essentially what he's saying.
Yes.
It's the poor against the billionaires.
Yes.
And people have liked that. A million people have voted for him in New York, which sets the trend. Similarly, we see a huge change in Greta Thunberg. Started out as an environmentalist, but now she says things like, well, the environment and Palestine and gender and class, all of it is one.
Yes.
Because it's all emerging from one system which we have to challenge. It's a huge shift.
So I want to ask you a question, and I noticed this in terms of, let's say, we have progressives in Pakistan, and they've also got a development model in mind. We've seen, I think, in this particular year, that the threshold for transnational violence has come down significantly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with the four-day war, with what was acceptable in terms of, like, nuclear escalation, we've seen that we also have a very hot neighborhood now. Mm-hmm. In fact, I've noticed that in the left, mm-hmm. you know, people have almost split. So those who've seen that this is existential and those who say, no, the old issues still remain.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering, is that in terms of, like, the development model going mm-hmm. forward, is that if you see that the country is growing at a pace population-wise that it cannot provide jobs for,
mm-hmm.
that it's become, you know, ground zero for mm-hmm. climate change, which it's not mm-hmm. responsible for, and then you have things like, obviously, neighborhood wars that we're doing and probably will, you know, increasingly move on for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Is what does that have as a, you know, change in how we're going to approach Pakistan and how we develop? Because there are those who consider this as part of, like, one of the rationale for the seeding of democracy as it's happening around the world, mm-hmm. because it's become. The other is also that there's just no way, given you've identified the financial constraints, that we can give enough for everyone.
Mm.
So what do you see this going forward? Because, I mean, we've got, like, these ideal words, and we've been talking about things like work wards and navel gazing and all that.
Mm.
But there are going to be real sacrifices going forward and compromises.
Mm.
Where do you think that's going?
What an interesting question. You know, the IMF wrote a report, and they've been saying this a while. They've been saying that Pakistan is experiencing what they term a multidimensional crisis.
Yes, the poly crisis.
The poly crisis.
Yes.
And
the perma crisis.
Perma crisis.
Yes, it just doesn't stop.
Good God! Yes. So, I mean, there's something to be said about that. That's not entirely incorrect, is it?
Yes.
As you yourself have pointed out. It's clearly the case that about 800,000 people are applying for visas to go abroad. They are going abroad. And people are getting on boats to go abroad and taking all sorts of risks to go abroad. And then we've gotten into this conflict with India. I mean, I don't need to go over the list, but recently the IMF also forced the government to publish that report on corruption, which is quite shocking.
Yeah.
6% of your GDP is kind of being affected by corruption is huge. So all of these things are there. There's no doubt about that. Maybe we should zoom out a little bit and look at this whole thing not from such an immediate point of view, but from a longer term point of view. And say, if we look at it, if we zoom out and we look at what's happened to Pakistan since 47, let's say, then perhaps you'd agree with me. I mean, I want your opinion on it, in fact.
Yes.
Is that we are reaching a sort of stage which we can characterize as a post-colonial crisis.
Well, actually, if I may interrupt.
Please.
So one of the things that I learned from you that I've never forgotten, and I was in...
You learned something from me?
Yes.
Wow!
Yes, and I've often told people about it. You were in a panel And I actually asked this question to you, and I thought it was phenomenal what you said. I'm just, this is a random
interjection. I'm so happy to hear this, yes.
because I was always fascinated by the fact that the Afghans, the Iranians, and the Indians despise the colonial masters.
Mm-hmm.
And we are like, no, the friends, they made the canals.
Yes.
We are almost to a degree like an outlier in terms of how we view colonial history.
That's right.
And that was the question I'd asked you. And what you said is because all these countries indigenized and went their own way, whereas we took a colonial institution, which at that time was the military, and it became the dominant institution. So, you know, the colonial structure just changed forms.
Yes.
And I found that fascinating in terms of how it broke down into why there's no resentment.
Mm.
I mean, maybe I'm oversimplifying it. There must be some resentment, but to be honest, not really.
Not really.
Yes. Yeah.
No, when we celebrate 47,
yes.
Who are we? What are we? Who is it that we're opposing in that celebration?
That's again another interesting thing, because it's not that the British left; it's that we got rid of the Hindus.
Exactly, but they weren't ruling.
Yes, they weren't.
They were not ruling.
Yes.
They were also under the British.
Yes.
So how could we have been? How could we talk about liberation from India when they're not ruling?
Yes.
They're not in power.
Yes.
So you know, it's kind of a contradiction which nobody examines. And in the speeches as well, nobody talks about the fact that, hello, yaar, 100 saal Britannia ne aap pe hukmarani ki.
Yeah.
And then there was an anti-colonial struggle here.
Yes.
And the actual struggle was against them.
Yes.
Why? Why bhi ho gaya?
Yeah.
So, yeah, so that's absolutely correct. But I think, although it kind of never took off in this particular instance, although there was a strong anti-Americanism at one time in Pakistan.
Yes.
And there still is on the religious right.
Yes.
But something else has happened also, Fassi, which is that that whole consciousness is now finished even in India. That whole consciousness is, in fact, finished in several third world countries, because that consciousness, that anti-colonial consciousness, was really the product of that moment in time from the First World War till the Second World War, the end of the Second World War, where massive anti-colonial movements erupted all over the third world. And that then continued forward in the form of national liberation struggles till about the 70s. Last big one was Nicaragua in 1980. But there was the Suez Canal crisis and the 67 war and, you know, Arafat fighting in Palestine. People really strongly associated with these movements. And in Pakistan, there was the, there was the Awami League on that side and the People's Party here. So there was this idea, there was this project that I would like to call a national liberation project. Or there was a project which was a project not so much of fighting the West politically, because that had been done in 47. I mean, that we were ostensibly independent. But there was a big project that we now have to become economically self-sufficient, stand on our own feet, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. And that project, more or less, was brought to a close by the 1980s.
So I want to ask you one final question before we close this. And I'm just wondering, is that we've identified the challenges. If we were to have a development agenda that would prioritize inclusion,
yes,
there's so much polarization. We don't want to talk to one another. There is, what are the points of commonality and agreement that still exist in a country like Pakistan?
Oh, huge, huge. I mean, we don't see them because we don't talk about them, and we don't talk about them because the powers that we don't want us to talk about them, they would rather that you and I fight on other things rather than we combine against them, right?
Yes.
So those are, for instance, the most popular ideas that you would find widespread support for is, let's start with education.
Yeah.
Everybody pretty much agrees that, except for maybe the people who say women should not be educated, the Taliban or whatever, but pretty much 95% of the population says, bachon ko taleem de. Theek hai? Pretty much everybody agrees we need better healthcare facilities. There's no debate about it.
Right.
There's no serious debate about these issues.
Yeah.
Pretty much everybody agrees that the basic necessities of life hai, they have been going up, inflation has been going up, has been making life miserable for everybody. Theek hai? Cost of living is going up. So everybody agrees that this has to be brought down. Even the capitalists, by the way, agree with this, because unki bhi cost of business goes up, with cost of living going up, with electricity and gas going up, right? So what do we have to do for these things? Ye dekhne ki zarurat hai. So, and everybody pretty much agrees that, yes, we want to grow faster.
Yes.
You know, because there's more economic opportunity and all of those things. So we have to examine what are the major roadblocks in that, in with respect to growing fast. And we cannot rely in this regard. If we come from outside, then we will invest, then we will grow. It's not like that. We're not, you know, some small country. We are a huge country.
Yeah.
We don't realize it. So, jab tak aap apne andruni mamla theek nahi karte, us waqt tak bahar se jitne marzi paise aa jaye, koi fark nahi padega. So, those are the key things that I think we need to address.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Taimur. I have absolutely loved this discussion.
Thank you.
And I hope that, you know, there are more of these. This was Let's Talk Development. It's a podcast jointly hosted by CDPR and IGC, and hopefully there'll be more of these. And once again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Fasi. It's a pleasure. It's always a pleasure talking to you. It's very stimulating, and you ask very challenging questions to which I've provided very simplistic answers.
They were excellent answers.
Please subscribe so you never miss a podcast, and comment below who you would like to see next.